agency. The Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division will come to order Wednesday, March 11th. The first item on our agenda today is the overview of the Historical Society finances, and welcome Ms. Archibald, Mr. Kelleher, and Ms. Archibald, I understand you have completed assignment number 2, or are prepared to present assignment number 2.
Madam Chair, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm in the habit of doing my homework, and I have brought my homework with me. However, Mr. Keller and I had a small dispute over the homework, and so I have actually finished my assignment twice. What you'll see here, which was my choice, was a photograph taken at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum with holding up a basket, a sweetgrass basket made by Margaret Hill, one of the Society's honorary council members and a Minnesota treasurer, a native member of the Mille Lacs community. And on this side is the chairman of our board. Ed Springer, former Supreme Court Justice, and Margaret in between us. And Ed has a basket, and so do I. That's my favorite one because it's northern Minnesota, which I love. It's outdoors. It's with an Indian woman who's a dear friend of mine, and with some beautiful objects that she made. Now, David, unbeknownst to me, snatched this picture from the office before I left yesterday, and it's a picture taken of me at Fort Snelling. Enjoying myself, dressing up. I still have a little girl in me enjoying to get dressed up. So here I'm actually Eliza Soulard from Prairie du Chien, who's making a visit to the fort.
It's just like when we visited.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I thought you might remember that, and so I brought it, even though this is my favorite assignment.
Thank you. They're both very appropriate, and perhaps we could pass them, since they're in plastic, we could pass them around so we could get close-up views.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you like me to proceed?
I would like you to proceed.
Thank you. I do want to thank you, Madam Chair, and all the members of the committee for this opportunity to present on behalf of the Historical Society. These are incredibly difficult days. One scarcely dares to turn on the radio and hear the reports of what's happening to people all around us. But I guess I want to leave you with two big messages in mind this morning as we go forward. One is that the Society is a team player in every way. We are going to do our part. We recognize the difficulty. It's going to be painful. We know it. And we got a little practice even in 09, FY09, to being team players. And we did it in many years leading up to the problems in 03. So we're accustomed to doing our part for the people of Minnesota, and we will continue to do that. And I think we offer the people of Minnesota a lot. I think the first and perhaps most important thing that we offer is context for their lives today, and their lives going into the future. Even as we were deciding to do a project which we have entitled Minnesota's Greatest Generation, which looks at the Depression years, World War II, and the economic boom that followed. Whoever thought that when we were beginning to work on this project several years ago and looking at the Depression materials and the situation of Minnesotans during the Depression, that it would have such relevance to people's lives today. This project has been underway for a number of years. We've published 7 books. We've done many, many oral histories. We have a Share Your Story website on our website where people can have contributed over 1,000 stories that relate to that period. So I think the context and relevance that we have for Minnesota's lives today is quite clear. We think about our programs as being first and foremost educational, but they're also entertaining. It makes education really enjoyable for people. We like to keep them affordable and accessible to wherever people in the state are. I'm going to be really not bolder than I should be and suggest that even as one of the things that happened to us in 03 was that we ended up with a lot of fees on for a lot of the things that we do, I think in the world that we live in today, if I had my way, and I think if we could all be as brave as we ought to be, for an organization that gives people context for their lives, relates to them directly, and is entertaining as well as educational, if we could go from fees to free, that would be my idea of a really brave goal for us as Minnesotans to have. The other thing I wanted just to call the committee's attention to is, of course, the relevance of a legacy amendment. How that all is going to play out, no one ever seems to know at this point. But I would point out that the words Minnesota's history are now in the Constitution for the first time in history, for which we're very grateful, and we consider ourselves clearly part of Minnesota's legacy. That's our fundamental responsibility, and we'll have an opportunity, I know, to talk with you in the not very distant future about the legacy amendment.
And part of our goal.
Yes.
Minnesota's history is part of our goal.
That's great. I think it should be. And when I speak to you, I feel like I'm kind of schizophrenic, because on the one hand, I speak as director of the Minnesota Historical Society. There's another half of me that believes these things passionately as a Minnesotan. So it's not just a matter of advocacy for my institution. The Society is 160 years old this year. I've got to say that we probably could say, more than any other organization, that we've seen it all, because we're the oldest institution in the state. And I guess if I could speak with a little gray hair and the wisdom of a 160-year-old organization behind me, I would say that Minnesota will prevail, we will come through this thing, and that the society will prevail. We have seen it all. And I guess with all of that as background, what I want to do is just give a very brief snapshot of the society, because I know many of you are familiar with the organization, and then go from there into the finances, where I know the heart of your questions probably are. The society has, I mentioned, is older than the state. We were actually the first institution created very shortly after Minnesota was established as a territory. We are guided, actually, by our territorial charter, which was written in 1849. And then updated in 1856. So these are the guiding documents. You feel a little silly sometimes going back to these arcane documents, but they are truly the documents that guide our work. We're governed by an executive council, which is elected by our membership, our 19,000 members, and they are active members, actively participating in the governance of the institution. We also are a quasi-government organization in that we have statutory responsibilities. Our statute 138 is a long and complex chapter, which we look to much as we look to our charter to guide us in our daily work. When I think about the mission of the organization, you can see it on the screen there. It's in two sentences. It's about preservation as well as about telling a story. But what I think about it at its essence is that we transfer the Minnesota story from one generation to the next. That is really our job. And we have responsibility at our heart. If you check our DNA, I think you'd find that we are fundamentally an educational institution. The education of the state's people is the essence of our work. We do it in ways that are painless and fun, but it is nevertheless our role. We like to say, when we're using highfalutin language, that we illuminate the past to light the future, giving perspective. And we do that by doing our basic activities, which are to preserve the evidence of the past, but also we have just a lot of fun telling stories. Our favorite mantra is to say that history matters. Again, education of all the state's people. We carry on core functions for state government, such as the state archives. We're essential to the tourism economy. When you talk to legislators, particularly legislators from smaller towns, about the impact of our historic sites on their community, we hear back that these sites are really important to them. And we have a responsibility, not only today's people, but we think we have a responsibility to future generations, to both to preserve the evidence so that they too can tell the story of Minnesota. We make all this happen with an incredibly well-trained and dedicated group of staff members, and the PowerPoint will show the org chart. I don't want anybody to attempt to read that. David tells me that it is included in the packet, so you can refer to that and see the way in which the organization works today. We do carry out that educational mission in a variety of ways. We operate historic sites, some 26 across the state. We operate museums, the State Museum at the History Center. And we also have a wonderful new museum that will be 5 years, actually was 5 years old and in September of 2008, and that's Mill City Museum. So we have a presence in the state's largest city as well as an important presence in the state's capital city. We prepare exhibitions and we take traveling exhibitions. An example of an exhibition we prepared ourselves, a long-term exhibition, will be Minnesota 150, which we put together to mark the state's sesquicentennial, 150th anniversary. But an exhibition that we have taken, that we've traveled from a network of history museums and history organizations, examples would be the American Presidency Exhibition, the Pulitzer Prize photograph. You see them at the History Center. We find that these traveling exhibitions, which turn over more quickly, bring a lot of traffic to the institution. When people know that there'll be an exhibition for 3 to 4 years, they may take their time getting there. They also get very irritated when it finally comes down. But if we have something that changes frequently, it brings people over and over and over again to the building. We have a very large library made up of over 500,000 books, manuscripts that fill a football field 30 feet high, maps, some 30,000 of them, and I would encourage all of you to come to see the map exhibition. We just opened it, I think it was a week ago, Saturday. They are fabulous maps, including the oldest map of St. Paul, which was rescued from a dumpster, literally. Some unwise person thought this wasn't relevant to anything, threw it away. Another person saw it in the dumpster, pulled it out, had some damage to it. We were able to repair it in our conservation lab, and that map is in the exhibition right now. There are many earlier maps as well that show the developing understanding of the interior of the country, getting a sense of what the Great Lakes really look like. Some of them have got the Rocky Mountains and kind of out of position right next door to Minnesota, but very, very interesting and often beautiful maps. Also, you will find there a new acquisition, the DeLeo Globe that some of you may have read about. It's only about this big, made in 1775 by the cartographer to the Queen of France. And it is an incredibly beautiful object. So if you get this relatively small exhibition, it won't take you long to see it, but it's absolutely worth the trip across the way to the History Center to have a look. We also have many, many photographs. If you go on our website and you go to our visual resources database, you will find approaching 200,000 images that you can look at, everything from the Stillwater Depot to the Duluth Depot, you name it. The photographs are there for your enjoyment. You can spend a lot of time on our website. You can take care of an afternoon. We publish books. The oldest activity we have is our Minnesota Historical Society Press. First book we published was with the Smithsonian Institution in 1852. It was a Dakota English dictionary. We continue to publish now. We are publishing about 2 books a month. This morning, I think particularly relevant would be the hard, what's the name of the ice book, what's it called? Hard Water, whatever. What is the title of the book? Hard Cold Water, whatever. We have a new book that's quite relevant to this morning's weather, I thought, anyway. We publish a journal. Our journal is called Minnesota History, aptly. And I met a woman on a plane recently who almost gave me the impression that our journal must arrive in a brown paper bag. She said, you know, I get that thing. She said, I get it into my house, and she said, I put it where I can find it. And as soon as I got a chance, I read it from cover to cover. And I said, that's okay, lady. It's okay to read Minnesota history. It's not a big problem. We work with our sister organizations around the state, over 400 county and local historical organizations who are concerned, as we are, and thrilled with the constitutional amendment. We provide technical assistance to them. We provide grants to them. We've been providing grants to them since 1969. I don't think in all the years I worked at the Society I ever have gotten a complaint about that program, because we work very closely with our applicants, and today they receive very, very small grants, and I think they look forward to a time when that might be better. Many of them that are eligible to receive bond dollars, if their buildings are owned by the municipality, are able to receive larger grants through some of the programs and appropriations you've provided. But the operating grants and general fund dollars are very, very, very small, and we hope that that will change. We work in historic preservation. If there's a major issue around historic preservation, we're likely to be one of the agencies, maybe a lead agency often, that will be working with local people. And we also conduct archaeology on our own historic sites. And we also conduct archaeology under contract with the Department of Natural Resources. I mentioned that we have many, many historic sites. They are defined in statutes. They are all over the state. They are Minnesota's most significant places. They are not the only historic places, but they are the most significant places. Mentioned that they're really important to the tourism economy, not only for our in-state visitors, but they are attractors for our out-of-state visitors as well. When you ask people what they do when they travel, they'll tell you that they like to visit historic sites. It's certainly something that I do, and I don't think it's just a busman's holiday. I think most people, when they travel, want to get a sense of the history of the place that they're visiting. They are clearly a destination for families, both in-state and out-of-state, and certainly they are a destination for school groups. Vast collections, I mentioned. most of them given materials given by the people of Minnesota. We hold these things in trust for the people of Minnesota, and we are making them increasingly accessible. I could not have sat here 10 years ago and talked to you about the kind of access that we're able to provide to items in our collections. After we had scanned, we barely had acquired the DeLille Globe. It had been scanned, and there was an entry on Wikipedia, and people were getting inquiries from around the world on that globe. It's that powerful a tool. You all know that. You use it. I use it. But what it has done is to take a institution that had collections that were wonderful, had been shepherded over over a century when I first came to the society. But then, you had to come to the building, the stacks were closed, it was a relatively inaccessible but precious resource. Today, it's a precious resource, and it is increasingly accessible. Obviously, it takes a lot to manage this operation that does a lot in terms of storytelling around the state and does a lot in terms of taking care of millions, literally millions of items. One of the things to point out about Minnesota Historical Society that makes it different from most other states is that all of it's concentrated in one organization. In many states, you'd find the functions that we undertake, the state archives, the state libraries, the state museum, historic sites, all managed by different entities. That creates a kind of inefficient system, not only for researchers and for learning about Minnesota history, but a financially inefficient system as well. We are consolidated in one organization. We have to support that organization with responsible financial management, which we are known for, I would say, and also our people, which in fact are our most precious resource, and we take care of them through a very caring human resources department. With the amount of information technology that supports not only our collections, but we also know, you all know, that the computer has outstripped the telephone as the most useful communication device on your desk. And that's no less true at the Historical Society. So we have our IT department not only has to manage the collections information with millions of items, but it also has to provide the support for the communication system statewide that the society has. And increasingly, the web is a place for business development as well. We're able to sell, we're able to raise money, people can renew memberships and do many things on the web today. We're absolutely out there with our services. Over 700,000 people visited our site last year. 230,000 visitors came to the History Center. We saw over 270,000 school children who came for school visits. They came prepared. They come to the History Center. They visit our sites. They go to Mill City Museum. There are places where we could take more kids, but there are places where we literally can't take any more. And if you come on a spring day to the History Center, it's much like the Capitol. It is literally overrun with school groups. Many of these students come prepared. Their teachers have gotten material from us in advance, and the kids are having very good experiences at our facility. One of the things about which we're most proud is our History Day program. We have a very gifted staff member who has provided the leadership for that program. We have over 30,000 kids in Minnesota who today do History Day projects. These are much like the old Westinghouse Science Fair projects, where young people come up with there's a general topic that comes from the national office. And then these kids go and try to put together an exhibition, a one-person play, a research paper. They can do all kinds of things to explicate that topic. Many of our kids in Minnesota actually focus on Minnesota topics because the resources are there for them at the Historical Society and at our sister organizations across the state. And I have to say that our kids win big. 2 years ago, Minnesota kids had this accomplishment. There are 15 first place awards given in the nation. Minnesota kids took 5 of the 15. That's one-third of the first place awards. That's outstripping Texas, New York, Massachusetts, Ohio, Pennsylvania, states with populations that far outstrip ours. So our kids are doing really well. And we're tracking these kids even after they leave us. And some of them have come back to work for us after they've completed their education, some of them all the way through graduate school, and they're some of our best employees and the best employees that we can offer to organizations around the country. We have members, I mentioned, who elect our governing board, over 19,000 members, who are active with us. And I should say that over 1 million people use our website. We often tend to think about the people we see face-to-face as the people who are most important visitors, and they always will be important. There's nothing like a face-to-face communication. However, the fact of the matter is that over 1 million people are accessing us through our website, so they're a huge audience for us. We provide curriculum, which is used in the classrooms across the street. David's got a copy of our the curriculum that is used in many, many of the state schools. You'll see an image of, we can give you a list of the state schools that are all over the state who use it. These are ways in which I think we improve the teaching of history everywhere. And more than that, I guess I would say that what we can say about what the Society does is that it really, if you ask us who we really are, we're not only an educational institution, but we're really oriented toward the future. We're into the transmission of a story. We're into really the transmission of values. There is something very special about Minnesota. When I came here many years ago, expecting to go back to Massachusetts, I stayed here because I liked what I saw in this state. I liked its commitment to education. I liked its commitment to telling everybody's story. And I liked its geography. I liked everything about it. And so I find myself, after many, many years, many decades, still here in Minnesota and very glad that I am. Elmer Anderson, late governor, perhaps put it best. Basically, he said you can't count on the passing of values and a story from generation to generation happening automatically. It doesn't happen automatically. We have to take that responsibility. And if we care about Minnesota and we care about its values, something we ought to be looking at really hard in these hard times, we don't want to give these things up. These are the things that make the state very, very special. It's not just a cold place. It's a very special place. That completes my testimony, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to answer questions. David is going to take you through the financials and through the charts that you have in front of you, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just because you put this before us, I have a chance to ask a question that every time I've heard about this exhibit, that Minnesota's Greatest Generation, the plane, the aircraft that's being assembled, Is that a visual, or does that really have anything to do with Minnesota history, the physical piece?
The physical piece, per se, is in a sense a prop. It is an actual plane. It's a fuselage from a C-47, a transport plane, that, like the planes that were used to transport many, many people, many soldiers during World War II. This one is being outfitted. Those of you who know our program know that one of the things we do best is create experiences. If you think about Mill City Museum and you think about the Flower Tower, that's an experience that you have there where you almost feel like you're out of place. This plane, you'll be able to get inside of it. It's the real thing, acquired from somebody who buys planes, who's going to crash this plane up in Canada. It had been used during World War II, went to the Swiss, from the Swiss to the Israelis. When we got it, the Israelis had used it for many years. The plane was completely changed and has the markings of the D-Day planes on the exterior of it now, all restored by volunteers. People will be able to get inside that plane, to sit down, and to imagine that they're flying across the channel on their way to the beaches at Omaha. And you hear, as you sit down, the voices of Minnesotans telling you about what that experience was really like. Meanwhile, the plane shakes. There is strobe lighting. You have a sense that you're literally being shot at if you're in that plane. So the artifact is not the real thing in the sense that it's a Minnesota object, but it's a kind of plane that many, many thousands of Minnesotans would have flown in.
And Madam Chair, if I could just follow up. I've always been a little confused by that, because when I think of the other items in the museum, the windmill or the train cars or something, I mean, they are all things that presumably would be Minnesota. And so I've always wondered, are we just sort of buying into the national Greatest Generation thing here? Do we have any other place where we've done that in the museum, where we bring something in, that's an artifact that's not Minnesota?
I would say, Representative Hausman, Madam Chair, it's not really an artifact. It's really a prop in this sense, and nobody's going to say that this plane was made in Minnesota. You will find things in the exhibition. For example, along with that photo, I think on the front page there, I don't remember if we produced put on the front page, but that day a tank also came into the building. And that tank was actually made, it's actually a small, what they call a small armored vehicle, was made at the Ford plant, was one of 5,000 made at the Ford plant, and that will be clearly identified as a Minnesota artifact. But this, the plane is a little bit like, it's a set for us to tell a Minnesota story with Minnesotans telling what their experience was.
Representative Erdoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Archibald. First of all, I want to commend you for the fine job that I think the Historical Society does. I've had some first-hand experience working with you while doing some research over there. Mr. Coleman just took me around the map section a couple of weeks ago, and he really was impressed with the maps that you were referring to earlier. And with the Lincoln Bicentennial Commission, Mr. Kelleher and others have been working on with me. Really appreciate the work that the Historical Society does. I have a question and a comment. I know from time to time there's been talk about maybe turning the site over, like in Lower Sioux. Is there any serious thought to actually doing that type of thing?
Representative Erdahl, Madam Chair, their piece of legislation did pass the state of Minnesota a number of years ago, which authorized the Society to transfer the Lower Sioux site, which is an important site for the U.S. Dakota War of 1862, as you know very well, to turn that over to the Dakota people, to the Lower Sioux community. The legislation required the approval of the county commissioners and the local board of supervisors. There was resistance to that at that time. This happened, I think, back in 01 or 02 when there was tremendous financial pressure, and actually the Lower Sioux community had come forward and provided the dollars for the Society to run that site. They then asked if they could they please run it themselves as a place that was very important to their own history. We supported that. You all supported that. But the local people, through the County Board of Supervisors and the county commissioners, did not give it that support. Today, we are in a management agreement with the Lower Sioux community to train people to enable them to run that site in a responsible way and to tell a story that I think everybody needs to hear, which is a story that includes both the Dakota point of view and the point of view of the U.S. government in that incredibly bloody conflict. Right, and we will be staying, with them and doing the training as is clearly needed.
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, I was going to finish up with a comment that I had.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. I wasn't quite done yet. Just a comment. I just want to throw out an idea today. I think it's important that, through this committee or capital investment, that we continue to support programs and grants as we have in the past to the fullest extent that we can, given our current situation. But this committee, of course, deals with the constitutional amendment. And I guess it's a question and a comment. I'd like your reaction. What if we concentrated the extra money, if you will, that this committee has for supplementing into two areas, Fort Snelling and the Capitol, the renovation, the repairs needed in the Capitol?
Representative Erdahl, Madam Chair, I guess there's a lot of conversation that has to happen. Certainly Fort Snelling is an enormous priority for the Society. I didn't talk about that at all today, but probably if you ask me what is the single most important initiative ahead of us in terms of storytelling and preservation, I would say Fort Snelling. The Capitol clearly also is in need of renovation and has been for a number of years. We've been singing that tune for a long time. I don't know if I would say that those are the only two places that ought to be supported. I think there's a lot of need statewide as well, through our program, and there are many. I think we ought to use the constitutional amendment to think big about what the possibilities are, but boy, I surely would say that the Capitol and Fort Snelling ought to be on the list.
Thank you.
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, the next several slides will give you a snapshot of our budget,
and that's what we need here today.
Madam Chair, our state operating budget for the last couple of years is shown on the slide, just under $27 million for fiscal year 2008 and $24.4 million for fiscal year 2009. In fiscal year 2009, the governor's reductions in December and early January provided a reduction for us of $600,000. The governor's recommendation for the next biennium is $21,758,000 for FY10, $21,642,000 for FY11. The pie chart here gives you a quick view of where the overall budget for the society come from. The largest share is the state general fund appropriations, but those state dollars are supplemented by other sources of funding, including earned income, donations from individual corporations and foundations, and federal and state appropriations for various programs. The red section on the pie chart in this particular year is about 66%. Typically, the mix is about 60-40. I think there were some one-time appropriations in FY 2008 that show that as a little bit larger. What this costs each Minnesotan is approximately $4.80 in state general fund dollars to support the history programs that we operate for the people of Minnesota. And we think that that's a pretty good deal, just under $5 a person. The next slide shows you in a quick snapshot how we spend the money. And by far, the greatest expenditure is people, the staff who deliver programs, who curate the collections, and are out at historic sites helping our visitors to understand history and enjoy the site. 65% overall, our overall budget is made up of staffing. The other major portions are operating expense, other operating expense, that's utilities, office supplies, all that kind of stuff. And then the next largest chunk is what's called in your budget book other financial transactions. And what that really means is the debt service on the History Center, which is just over $2 million a year. We're a little bit unusual in that when the appropriation was made in the late 1980s, the debt service is shown as a part of our budget, which is not the case with most agencies. So you'll see that that passes into our budget and back out to the repayment of the debt for the History Center.
And when will the History Center be paid for?
Madam Chair, I don't know the exact date, but I think we're getting close. 2016. So we're getting close to that. And again, on the operations side, we maintain the History Center and about 135 buildings across the historic sites network, and I think something like 40% of those buildings are over 100 years old, so they require a great deal of care and maintenance. Back to the governor's recommendation on the next slide. The governor's recommended budget is a reduction of $2.7 million each year, or $5.5 million for the biennium. That's a 15% reduction of our state budget, and I should take a moment to explain that. When you back out the debt service, which obviously we cannot cut the debt service, that's an obligation of the state, as well as the building services for the History Center, which passed through to the Department of Administration's Plant Management Division, and it's difficult to cut those because that's utility and those kinds of things. It's 15% on that smaller base. If you include on the larger base, which includes debt service, the figure is closer to 11 or 12%, but 15% on the operating base that we have control over. We also have challenges in our non-state revenues. I showed you in the slide a couple of slides ago, donations from individuals and revenues from places like historic sites. Those areas are hurting as well with the economy. Donations are down from individuals, people's individual portfolios are down, foundation portfolios are down. So we're challenged across the board in our state appropriation as well as the various non-state appropriations that we rely on due to economic conditions. Madam Chair, I will pause there if there are any questions on the budget. That's a very quick overview. You have in your budget book something that looks like this, and we can walk through the pages in the budget book and take any questions from there.
Mr. Kelleher, how many employees did you say?
Madam Chair, our staff is comprised of 181.9 full-time equivalents of full-time employees and 202.9 full-time equivalents of part-time employees. And the part-time employees are staff who are either part-time year-round or full-time seasonally at historic sites. They'll work in the main part of the season from Memorial Day to Labor Day. So that totals about 700 people who pass through our payroll system in any given year, but the total is about 380 FTE, full-time equivalent.
And that's what percent of your total budget?
About 65%, Madam Chair.
So with the governor recommended 15%, was it, reduction, and would a disproportionate amount of the 65% be reduced by that 15%?
Madam Chair, because we have a number of fixed costs, such as utilities, et cetera, et cetera, any reduction is going to fall on people, on staff, because it is such a large proportion of our budget. We have an obligation to maintain the buildings of the historic sites network. Even if the functions are reduced at those sites, we have to keep the heat on and maintain the buildings. So, yes, to answer your question, yes, it's, reductions do fall disproportionately on staff, on people.
Madam Chair, I just might add that we have done some calculation, and we're not to the specifics yet, but we think that between people, staff members supported on state funding and non-state funding as well, on the revenue that we take in our historic sites, for example, we think that the impact is going to be about 65 to 85, somewhere in there, full-time equivalent positions that will be lost. I should just for context also say that when we went through this between FY02 and FY05, we had 106 people who were laid off at that time, and an additional 188 people had their hours reduced. So there's been a lot of impact on the society in this first decade of the 21st century.
You went, Ms. Archibald, when you said that you were a team player, that the Historical Society was a team player, when other agencies or accounts under this committee's direction received 5 or 10% reductions and you received 15%, did you feel like you were a bigger part of the team?
Too big a part of the team, Madam Chair. No, what I was trying to say is that we understand what this financial pressure really means, and we know that we're going to be suffering from it. There's no question. I guess the important thing is for all of us to recognize as we read the paper and we see the people who are being laid off that these are real people, these are positions, and we had a lot of people who had an impact on their lives that we put out on the street before, and we're going to do it again at this level. The only way we can, the way in which we've done the calculation is to assume that the governor's budget will hold. There's no other way. I mean, otherwise it's Ouija board stuff. So if the governor's recommendation holds, we think we're going to lose between 65 and 85 FTE. I think that's the best guess. If you decide to do something different, that'll be, if it's in the right direction, that'll be wonderful.
Before the governor's budget was published at all, or while it was being put together, were you consulted?
Madam Chair, not to my knowledge. David?
Madam Chair, we had conversations with Minnesota Management and Budget to discuss what was happening, and we submitted information to them throughout the budget process. I guess I would say that the 15% was maybe a little bit higher than we expected, because other, as you mentioned, other agencies seem to be in the 10% range, 5% range for some. So,
out of the 65 to 85 FTEs, what I don't know if you can tell us this, but in greater Minnesota, there are jobs with your institution, and there are jobs down here in the metro area with your institution, and the greater number are down here, I'm sure, but would they be, because there's fewer people in greater Minnesota, would there be more of the 65 to 85 employees, would they be a bigger...
Madam Chair, at this point we don't have the specifics on this, but I will tell you this, and that is that this will have an impact on every part of our institution. One of the things we're trying very hard to do is to maintain service of some kind everywhere. We understand, you know, when something happens in a small town or even a medium-sized town in rural Minnesota where we're having to cut hours or even to close a site, the impact is huge on that community, and we know that. So we're working very hard not to have those kinds of impacts, but I think we're kidding ourselves if we think nothing is going to happen, because it will. One thing, I would just return to the team player notion. We, all of us could see, we were very concerned as we were coming forward on all of this, even as early summer. And so in July, you can talk about team player, the society put a hiring freeze on, and it was a hard freeze. We were hiring people to work part-time jobs in our historic sites so we could keep them open. But any of the hiring on permanent positions that we could possibly freeze, they've been frozen, and it has saved money for us going forward, which helped us with the money that the governor asked for in 2009. Our employees are currently being furloughed to get through 2009. We have anybody who makes less than $35,000 a year was unaffected by the furloughs. There's a graduated furlough up to 8 days for everyone, and this means everyone from anybody making $36,000 to the top of the organization being furloughed for at least 8 days, and it's a graduated system. So it's not as if we haven't recognized that this was coming and done nothing about it. The other side of the coin is that, you know, this is an organization that is quasi, and so we do have non-state dollars, but our non-state dollars are shrinking as well. People can't give. We're earning nothing on our account. If we're earning anything, it's a red number rather than a black number. I mean, we're no different from anybody else that has money invested. We all look at our 401ks that come to our house, and I've stopped looking. I can't take it anymore.
It's better to do that.
Better not to look.
Yeah,
I think so. That was my conclusion.
Are any of your employees members of collective bargaining units?
No, Madam Chair, they are not.
So they're all. Okay, that completes. That completes my questions about the budget so far. Representative Lawfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Archibald, for your dedicated service. I know it's not just a job for you, it's a passion. When I see you at various meetings, it's obvious. To what degree does this agency really also absorb fallout from other cuts in other parts of the state budget? I mean, I was struck by, for example, that 48% of the schools are using the Northern Light curriculum, and I suspect a lot of it has to do with whether or not they're able to buy the textbooks to update their collection. I look at the Historical Society Press, and I suspect in the past, the library throughout the state, which is another budget account of ours, would typically, I mean, the Minnesota Libraries, you'd think, would be one of the major purchasers of those books. I suspect now that we have interlibrary loan, what you find out is that many of the libraries choose not to, and if their residents are interested, they borrow it from one of the larger collections who might have the larger library systems, whether it's Hennepin or St. Paul or someplace else that may have invested in that. Are you starting to find, you know, even in terms of visitor center, I see that we've kind of, you know, plateaued even before this downturn on visitors. Is that because the school groups are pulling back on field trip money? I mean, can you give us a sense of how much other budgets are intertwined into the success of your earned income?
Representative Lawler, Madam Chair, I guess I do not have hard data on that, but I think you're perceptions trying to spin this out probably are quite correct. We see, for example, I know that the sales in our, on our press are way down. If you look at, you've been following what's been happening with Borders or Barnes & Noble. People aren't buying books. They are finding other ways to get access to information, whether it's the web or they're borrowing books that have been acquired through interlibrary loan or whatever, but the sales are down. And a lot of the sales would be to libraries, clearly, as well as to individuals. So I think there are the signs out there. I don't know what the schools are doing in terms of their, they're on a regular cycle to purchase books as the kids consume the books, but that they might slow that down. If I were a superintendent of schools, that certainly would be a place that I would be looking to see if I could slow down, because books are expensive. David, do you have anything other than anecdotal evidence? I think it's an interesting question. It's not one that we have looked at, frankly.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you very much. I have a question that relates to program and to dollars. Your website, you're indicating, takes a million hits. I was wondering if that website creates any dollars directly, or does it possibly build membership, therefore dollars indirectly?
Ms. Archibald.
Yes, Representative Madam Chair. There is some revenue that comes from the website. We do provide, large part of our research base is people interested in family history or community history. It's individual, it's local, it's very specific. And so we do provide copies of birth and death certificates, and there is a charge for those. They are not legal documents per se that you could use in a law case, but they're very useful to our researchers who want to see them. So we do sell those things online. Memberships are sold online, and money is raised online. You can make a gift to the society online if you choose to do that. I would say that's a piece of our work that people are just getting used to it. I would say as a donor myself, not only to the society but to other organizations, I've made plenty of gifts to organizations, but I've never done it online. I suspect it's like everything else. It took me a while to put my credit card online. Probably will take me a time to make a gift online, but it's certainly possible. I think it's a probably growing part of our business.
Simple follow-up. If I come to a facility, do I have to have a membership? Do I pay for that membership?
If you
Do I pay to enter, or can I get in on a membership that I paid for? Does it cost me money to get inside?
Representative, Madam Chair, if you are not a member, it does cost you money. One of the fallouts from 03, from the problems of 03, was that we had to put a charge on the History Center. I said that I would go over my dead body before we put a charge on the History Center. Well, I was flattened. We had to, because we reduced the hours to the point where it was absurd. We were closing the doors at 3 o'clock. I'd see people coming to the door and walking away. We couldn't go on that way. So we put a charge on the History Center. If, however, you are a member, you would get into the History Center for free and get into all of our historic sites for free. So there are ways to get around that. The membership is not very expensive. You want to give the specific, David? I think you can start at maybe $45 for a membership. And if you're going to be visiting Split Rock, Fort Snelling, coming to the History Center two or three times, or going to Mill City Museum, it's clearly a great deal for a family.
One last.
The library, Madam Chair and Representative, does remain free. Anyone can come in. It's a free public library, even though it's a very serious research library.
One last follow-up. I think it's a postulate someplace. A good way of creating dollars is to have a minimum cost to a maximum amount of people. And you have a million hits on your website. You might want to be doing something creative. Thank you.
Mr. Kelleher, could you provide us in writing some possibilities of places where there could be fees or where there are fees and what those fees are?
We could certainly do that, Madam Chair.
And interest. Interesting. Thank you. There are four pass-throughs. Would you
sit
on those, leaving out, take the two, not Farm America and International. We'll leave those because there's people here to talk about them, but...
Madam Chair, as you stated, there are four pass-throughs, and the legislature determines from time to time that there are some ongoing and some one-time pass-through appropriations, which you ask us to administer the funds to those organizations. They are the Minnesota Air National Guard Museum, which in the governor's recommendation is $13,000 just in the first year of the biennium. The Minnesota Military Museum, $85,000, again, just in the first year of the biennium. The Minnesota International Center, and Carol Byrne, who is with the International Center, is here to answer any questions you may have. And then Farm America, which receives 100, and under the governor's recommendation, 109,000 each year. And again, there are folks here from Farm America to make a presentation for the next bill before you.
Mr. Kelleher, where's the National Guard Museum and the other one?
Madam Chair, the Air National Guard Museum is out by the Twin Cities Airport, close to Fort Snelling, and then the Minnesota Military Museum is up by Camp Ripley near Little Falls.
Sure, I've been there. All right. And you don't say, this is a good expenditure, this is a bad expenditure, you say, here's a check.
Madam Chair, correct. And you had asked for some information. There's a copy of the, as a handout, the presentation that we made to your committee about a month or so ago about grants. The pass-throughs are distinct from the competitive grant programs that we operate with state dollars, with federal dollars, with other dollars, in which folks apply for a grant and go through a staff review and a committee review process before the grants go out. And as you pointed out, the pass-throughs are legislatively designated. We administer those dollars at your request.
Madam Chair, I just would like to add something about those two organizations. The volunteers from the Minnesota Air National Guard Museum were responsible, many of them, for the Jenny, the creation of the Jenny, which hangs in the History Center today, and they also did. They were put in countless hours of work to restore the fuselage for the plane that is going to create the experience for our Minnesota experiences over that have to do with landing at Omaha. So they're the ones who sanded the plane and stripped the plane and riveted and painted and all this, did all the other work on it. So we have a very close relationship with the Air Guard Museum. The museum at Camp Ripley, there are staff members there who helped us greatly with also with the Greater Generation Project, doing it because they're knowledgeable, they know a lot of the vets, and they did a lot of the interviews for our Greatest Generation interviews, and they've been an enormous help to us, and I just want to express appreciation to them publicly.
And Mr. Kelleher, are you going to, and Ms. Archibald, are you going to be present on Monday night to tell us about your vision and expectation of the constitutional amendment money?
Madam Chair, yes, we will, and we'll bring some friends.
We'll await that opportunity then. One real quick question I have. Do you ask people, Ms. Archibald, when they're joining your society, the Historical Society, do you ask them to show IDs? Or do you just accept their check when they send in their membership check?
I don't believe, Madam Chair, when they buy a membership, say, online, that we ask them for any particular ID. When they come into the library, they do have to register, because much of what our patrons and our visitors are using in the library are one-of-a-kind materials. Not all of them, but many of them are. So we do ask people to register, and we know who is using the collection, certainly.
And do you ask for a photo ID at that time?
I think probably it's a driver's license that is asked for. Yes, Michael says yes, our deputy director says yes.
All right. For your annual membership voting, do you ask for a photo ID?
No, Madam Chair, we do not. There's an annual meeting of the membership in November, and people come and they elect our governing board, and there's a process for doing that, and they approve whatever they are looking at, the membership, but there is no photo ID process.
And they just have to show their membership.
Yeah. And their
the reason I ask is because I sent a check in last year for my St. Louis County, and I know that's just another historical society separate from you, but they didn't ask for any ID for my check to become a member, and they sent me my membership. But now, if I go on March 17th, the annual meeting, and I want to vote, I have to show my membership card and a photo ID.
Well, Madam Chair, we have not done that, and I don't know.
Madam Chair, I'd be glad to vouch for you if you need me.
It doesn't say anything about vouchers. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
members
Chair.
Of the committee.
That was a bit peculiar. The International Center, Ms. Byrne, you have a short statement. Am I correct? Short, like a minute?
I can make it a minute.
Please.
Madam Chair and distinguished members of the committee, my name is Carol Engelbertson Byrne, and I'm the president of the Minnesota International Center. And it was founded in 1953, and our mission is to inspire our community to understand international issues and cultures in the ever-changing world. We're part of a national network of World Affairs Councils across the United States, and we are the sixth largest in the country out of 87. Last year, over 36,000 Minnesotans, adults and children, participated in one of the 1,861 activities that we sponsored in homes, classrooms, workplaces, and communities across the state. I'm here today to ask you to please support the Minnesota International Center's wide line item of $37,000 in 2010 and 2011 in the governor's budget, under the pass-through with the Minnesota Historical Society. And the Minnesota International Center has been receiving a small amount of state funding since the early 1970s. Our mission to inspire our community to understand international issues and cultures in an ever-changing world is carried through with four major programs. The first is our World Affairs programs, and these are public forums where we bring in world leaders, business leaders, media, to Minnesota. And last year we hosted ambassadors from France, Morocco, Norway, as well as Nobel Peace Prize laureate Mohamed Yunus and many others. And you've got in front of you our latest newsletter as well as our annual report. Our fastest growing program is our schools program, K-12 schools program, International Classroom Connection. And this is where we bring international speakers and scholars into Minnesota schools. And this is a program that's lively, interactive. It puts a personal face on a complex world. And this program has grown dramatically. After September 11th, 2001, in 1 month alone, we had a 300% increase of requests from schools asking for this program. And schools said, this isn't a luxury, it's imperative for our kids to know about the world. And last year, over 25,000 Minnesota school kids had speakers in their classroom through the Minnesota International Center. Also, we host the U.S. State Department International Visitor Leadership Program. This is run by the State Department. We're the coordinators of this program, where we bring in emerging leaders from around the world to meet with their professional counterparts. And many of you may have met with these State Department international visitors. And lastly, we have a grassroots program, which is called Great Decisions. It's like a book club, except we discuss international issues. And in Minnesota, we have 54 of these Great Decisions groups, ranging all the way up from International Falls down to Blue Earth. And I know that many of you representatives have Great Decisions groups in your communities. Our budget this last year was a little bit over $1 million. Our funding sources are, the majority comes from individual membership, corporate membership, also events, foundations. We have this state appropriation and a small federal grant because we're the state coordinator for the State Department International Visitor Leadership Program. We also have a staff of 11 full-time, 6 part-time, and a base of over 1,000 volunteers. And for the past 56 years, I think our organization has been educating and engaging Minnesotans in an ongoing exploration of international issues and cultures. Today, our mission is more important than ever. And so I think what we do is we take together MIC programs, we build a context of international understanding and effective cross-cultural communication to ensure that those living in Minnesota are competitively positioned to live, work, and lead in our globalized workplaces and multicultural communities. So thanks so much for this opportunity, and happy to answer questions.
Of the $37,000, is that seed money, or does that buy a person, or
does that, what does that buy?
Well, it's for general operating, but I would say, about 65% of our budget is for staffing, so certainly this is very helpful. We're a nonprofit organization, so that amount would probably pay for two of our junior level staff people.
Are you 501c?
Yes, we are.
And that's why you're passed through the history.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Representative Cornish, House File 1121.
Well, he's on his way up, ma'am.
Representative Colbert.
I did not participate in any of your assignments, but I do have a report for you. It's in the packet of the Historical Society that they handed out to you. The history field trip.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my three grandchildren.
And they're outside.
They're up in the tower, the fire tower, 100 feet above the air.
And when they come down, then they walk outside.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So they are embracing our natural resources and environment.
Right on.
All right, your assignment number two, Representative Solberg, is complete. Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, I guess there was a little bit of confusion on my part here. Did you want us to restrict our comments to the actual budget today or House File 1121 about the legacy amendment money for capital?
Well, I thought we were going to talk about your budget, but then in my packet I saw 1121, so go for it.
Okay.
But Representative Solberg has the bill, too.
Madam Chair, how much time would you like me to use, and I can judge how much I should give my testifier?
About 6 minutes.
Okay, and if you would, about 1 minute before the fire, hold up your gavel and give me a signal.
Mr. Chen will do that.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'll talk fairly fast, and what I do, rather than go through actual budget figures, I'd like to try something a little different. If you would pick up your magazine that says Farm America at the top and go to page 4. What we're doing here basically today is trying to find a home. We've been bounced around over numbers of years to different committees and tried to get funding. In 1978, Farm America was commissioned as the Agricultural Interpretive Center for Minnesota. We have a Iron World up in Chisholm. We have a Forest History Center in Grand Rapids and the Agricultural Interpretive Center in Waseca, or not far from Waseca. We were started out with some seed money to build the center. It's 120 acres, and you'll see on page 4 as you go through, there's a tarmac or a tar road going completely around to all these different exhibits. A complete whole farm, a church, a school, a feed mill, and the blacksmith shop, and it ends up at an impressive agricultural hall museum at the end. Thousands of visitors every year. The thing that's impressive about this place is it operates almost wholly on volunteers. You talk about different organizations operating, and a lot of committee questions are how many FTEs you have, and we've tried everything you can to raise money. The people here raise their money on pancakes, waffles, breakfast. They raise their money on the rental of the visitor center for weddings. They've got 250 volunteers a year that work this, and they only got 2.25 FTEs. The director is only a quarter time, and they have 2 employees to help the director out. That's it for employees. It's run almost totally on volunteers. The governor's budget, basically, the recs were to cut us 14% from $128,000 a year to $109,000. The problem is they've been robbing that operating budget to keep all of these buildings going. Inside the packet, you'll see there's a number of requests we've made for capital improvements over the years. The problem with the capital improvements is we don't qualify for bonding. We've gone all the way to the Department of Administration or Finance or the Governor's Office in Farm America since it's private, doesn't qualify for bonding money.
And the only way we can qualify is to turn it over to the county or the city for bonding money, and that's even tough to do. And neither one of them can take it on because they have enough of their own to do and just can't, you know, in these budget times, take control of Farm America. So we're really struggling to find a home, to find the finances to keep it going. Very impressive with school buses up there, kids running around, the carriages going around to the different sites, and tractors pulling people, and several events during the year. And I'd like to introduce myself.
We've been there, Representative Cornish, Representative Hausman and I.
What's that mean?
We've been there.
Oh, yes. The Heritage, I think it was called the Difference, the committee before when it was Gerald.
We were there with Bondi.
Oh, okay.
I have a rock in my rock garden.
Oh, okay.
That represents Dorman kidnapped from holding a door open at Farm America.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to introduce my testifier, Judy Leach. She's a teacher from Wasika in the third grade.
Ms. Leach, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. As you said, my name is Judy Leith, and I teach third grade at Hartley in Wasika, Minnesota. For the past 14 years, my students have had the opportunity, in conjunction with the social studies unit about pioneers and our ancestors, to go to Farm America and do a hands-on experience. During that time, we have let the kids do a lot of different things. They visit the settlement, they go to the pioneer site, they go to the school, they go to the church, the blacksmith shop, the 1930s farmhouse and outbuildings, and have had a chance to do many hands-on experiential type things like planting crops by hand, seeing and learning about the various animals, the oxen, the goats, the horses, all those different things that are there. Attend school as if they were pioneer children. We even pick a naughty student and they end up having to stand in the corner as they may have done in the pioneer times, grind corn by hand and experience life as some of their ancestors would have done. We ask our children to dress as pioneers. They bring a pioneer lunch and we teach them games from the past as well. So it's a very hands-on experiment for them. The staff at Farm America has done a tremendous job of planning and implementing programs for us, and as Representative Cornish said, countless hours are done with the volunteers that are there to make it a very worthwhile learning experience for our students. Our kids always come back telling how many things they've learned from it, and just last week I happened to run into a lady who said, oh, I just had my kids home and they were talking about the things they had learned at Farm America, and these are college age and above kids, so we know that it makes a long-term impression upon them. We found that we also exposed parents at that time, too, to many opportunities that they haven't seen at Farm America because it's a local type thing. One thing we have discovered that with the aging of some of the buildings, it takes a lot of maintenance to preserve these historic assets and exhibits and keep them safe for all the students and adults that do go out there. The hovel was in disrepair, as was one of the pioneer houses for a while. We could not let the children go there. The kids were disappointed. They couldn't see that. Luckily, with some funding, they've been able to restore those, so they are experiencing that at this time. We would like to see some more things added for current agriculture, and they're looking at possibly could we do something in the visitor center that has some interactive things that include modern agriculture. Even though we live in a rural community, we have very few children who are exposed to those agricultural type things anymore. So there are over 2,000 kids who get to visit and over 20,000 visitors total that come out there during the year, and any funding considerations that could be given to maintain, restore, and add to the things that are happening at Farm America would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Madam Chair, this is Bill Holverson, a board member from Farm. Just came along with this question, okay. Technical question.
Thank you. And Ms. Lisa, did you take a day off today?
I will be going back as soon as I'm done testifying.
Okay. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for your willingness to volunteer and participate in this activity in your community. Representative Cornish, your bill 1121, I'm not sure what there's no place to pass it on to at this moment because you're asking for no,
Madam
you
Chair,
are.
I'd be fine with if you wanted to hold it over.
I'm going
to
hold it over for a while until I figure out what we're going to do. But you're asking for $435,000. What if the $132,000?
Madam Chair, in this packet you'll find a detailed list of every project item by line item.
No, not project, but what does the base money that comes from the state pay for? Is that your director? Is there one employee that's paid full time?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Hoverston, I'm a member of the Board of Directors. We have two full-time employees, an office manager and a site manager, and a quarter-time executive director. And the $109,000 per year that the governor has in his budget would go for toward our operating budget of about $280,000 per year. So it's a supplement to our operating budget. We raise the rest of it through fundraisers and grants. And this bill was designed and focused on the legacy amendment funds, as I understood it. And we are looking for some maintenance funding of about $133,000, as Madam Chair just referred to. And then the rest of it would be for interactive exhibits within the visitor center at Farm America.
So for capital and operating.
This particular bill would not include operating money. It would be in addition to the $109,000 that the governor has in his budget, so we can do maintenance and repairs on the buildings and do the interactive exhibits.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hausman.
Madam Chair, I'm looking at slide four. What is the Minnesota Agricultural Interpretive Center, and it's by two other centers, and maybe Representative Solberg is the one that has to answer this. Do we treat all three of them the same? And what I heard you say is it is yours is still private. Yours is still privately owned. Is that correct?
Representative, Madam Chair, we are a 501c3 organization. We are not affiliated or attached to any governmental agency as we operate.
He answered that question for Lasika. The Forest History Center is part of the Historical Society, and the Iron World Discovery Center in Chisholm is funded by the IRRB. We have now given them a fairly large grant of an endowment fund, and they have their own private operation of it. So it's although the IRRB does supplement their budget for a few years while they're changing over from a state agency or a semi-state agency to
a 501.
For a 501, I believe, yeah.
Thank you very much. We will do what we can.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And Representative Cornish has the... if I have questions, I can contact Representative Cornish, and he can get the answers from you, right?
That's
okay.
Madam Chair, I should say that this is going to be starting tomorrow. This will be Corey Katz's bill. He'll be chief author of it, and I'll be second author on the motion tomorrow. Since he's in Waseca and this is in Waseca, I talked to him about it, and he's going to take the bill. So he was going to be here today, but he had to chair a committee. So.
Thank you. Representative Solberg, House File 1008.
Madam Chair, I think we can bring this before the committee, and then I think the intent is to also keep it here for a short time. Distinction on this particular bill is that every member of the committee is a co-author on this bill, so it should be a slam dunk. I don't know if the staff
but
is involved.
But we signed on in better days.
I'd like to have Laura Mangan from the Department of Administration come up and do some testifying, but this is a bill that's been worked on with the public radio, public TV, and others on how they handle their grants with the Department of Administration, and I think it would be best if we just let the Department of Administration and others kind of explain the bill and why it's needed.
I welcome that information, because I've been trying to figure out how the grants are awarded and in what way are they presented and who gets. I know that public broadcasting does and the radio stations do, but I don't have any faith in it. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Lenore Madigan with the Department of Administration. I'm the financial manager for ADMIN. ADMIN is the fiscal agent for the public broadcasting grants. The specific reason we're here today is we've been meeting and communicating with all the public broadcasting grants over the last several months because we want to ensure the processes we have in place are done in accordance with the new state grant policies. And I believe Kristen Batson, the grants manager, appeared before your committee about the specifics of these policies. And the grant policies that have been implemented and that we'll be using with these grants really do provide more consistent, transparent state processes. And we believe that implementing the grant policies, which will be provided through this legislation, will improve upon our current process. I'm going to just talk for a minute about how the current process works today. Today, public broadcasting entities provide a recommendation to the Commissioner of Administration on the specifics of the disbursement. Then annually, administration, or I, send out application information to each station. And then each station submits the information to administration. And the specifics are in the Chapter 129, but it includes everything from how many staff they have, to their financial statements, to how they've been spending their money, those sorts of specifics. The stations then submit to us the requested information, and then ADMIN reviews the submittals. We are in conversation with the stations about the information they submitted. There's, some stations are better than others about what they submit, so some go more smoothly, others there's a lot of back and forth, making sure we understand that they've met the requirements of the funds. And then once those requirements have been met, ADMIN disperses the funds. How this legislation will ultimately change, and I know it isn't exactly written that way today, is that we'll begin entering into grant agreements with each one of the public broadcasting entities, and we really believe that will also streamline the process for the submittals because we'll do it for each biennium, and that's how the funds are today designated or distributed. Any questions?
Do they have to provide outcomes?
The stations do not provide us with outcomes. Now, there may be more information. The public broadcasting groups want to talk about that. They provide us with very concrete information about how they're spending the funds in their operations. They provide us with information about their stations, the programming they do, but specific, we serve this many people, we don't ask for that, but they do, that is part of their submittal.
And do you get receipts?
We rely on their financial statements that have been audited.
Who gets the checks? The station manager?
The checks are distributed depending on what the public broadcasting group is. Sometimes they're educational institutions, and then it goes to the college, if that is who it is. In other cases, it goes to the radio station. So, like if there's a station in Grand Rapids, it goes to that station. It doesn't go to an individual.
KAX?
Yeah, KAXD, correct.
I learned that yesterday.
Very good.
That's a good station, ma'am, sir.
That's what they told me. That's what they told me. Representative Solberg, do you know more about this than I do?
Well, Madam Chair, probably a little bit more, but I never want to be smarter than the chair of a committee.
It's okay on this one, because this is so brand new to me that I'm having a hard time getting my mind around it, and I know Mr. Godbert doesn't have a big problem with it, but I just, it's so vague.
I think that what they've experienced in the past, particularly my understanding is for some of the smaller stations, is some of the paperwork that is kind of unnecessary for them to be able to get some of their grants. I think the Department of Administration has done a great job on making sure that the grants are used for what they're supposed to be used for. And if it's an attempt to be able to streamline that process somewhat. That's my understanding of the grants. For some of the smaller public stations, they don't have a great deal of staff as opposed to some of the bigger entities. And I think it helps to streamline the process and to still get that oversight that we want to have within so that the grants are used for what they're supposed to be used for.
Representative Houser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're getting to the end of our time, and I wanted to just ask a question about Section 3 and Section 5. Section 3, why would we strike those requirements about audit? And then Section 5, Madam Chair, you and Representative Silver know that we've had this discussion in bonding, and in fact have a bill coming up. Again, I would think we would have to treat all entities the same, and that is if there are state funds there, that they would all have to be treated the same in terms of repayment. And library facilities grants fall under this, and I think the agreement was that right now, even if there's engineering dollars and they never construct, or in the case of library grants, which are $2 million, that in perpetuity, the state has an interest. And we were even trying to say, for the life of the loan, could we say after the life of the loan, but I think there hasn't even been agreement about that. So this strikes me as similar, and I, once we set a precedent, do we then argue it applies to every other state entity?
Madam Chair, if I may answer this, my understanding of Section 5 is that these are not bonding grants. Bonding grants would still be underneath the same provision that you've talked about. And I think there are bonding dollars that go into these particular entities. If that's the case, then they have to follow the rules of bonding. This, I think, is state grants. That's with cash. That's my understanding. And so that's probably why the changes. And it's probably for equipment that does not necessarily have a lifespan of 20 years as bonding would be. Section 3, I'll let someone ask answer. Someone else answer.
When we were meeting with the various entities, we learned that for educational institutions, how the language is worded in the current 129D is problematic for people because there isn't always a specific, the timing of the audit is difficult. And so there's no intent to change in terms of receiving audits or having them be certified either by the Public Broadcasting Association. And the public broadcasting groups could probably speak better to that specific provision as to why it was difficult for them.
And Madam Chair, I remember Hausman, I think an audit is still required. I think it's just how prescriptive it is, because it does say in 2.34 that a copy of the most recent audit shall be filed.
Correct.
But Ms. Madigan, when the grants director of administration came and talked to us about the new program, they talked about uniformity and making grants across in all departments,
correct,
and agencies same or similar.
Yes, and that's what this process would do. We would have a grant agreement. And matter of fact, Kristen Batson met with us with all the public broadcasting groups to develop the grant agreements, shared them with the stations, specifically walked through what their requirements would be, how they would submit. So that is the process we follow.
So you've had training classes?
We've met with all the public broadcasting representatives and met with Kristen on how we should be doing this.
That's correct. And they were happier than they had been before when they were sending in the onerous written documents they had to send?
I think we believe it'll be easier for them once we're through the first biennium, because they won't have to resubmit everything annually as they do now. They'll resubmit things that change during the biennium. There'll be a grant agreement for each biennium. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think there are also some technical amendments, I understand, that need to be made to this bill, and they're not prepared.
But they're going to get to me, because
yes.
I'm going to hold this.
Yes, I want you to hold
for our document that we're going to submit one of these days to introduce as a bill, and then we'll be having an omnibus bill for our account. Mr. Tilley, Mr. Kaczynski, do you want to add any clarifying remarks in the next minute and a half?
Perfect. Madam Chair, I'm Bill Kaczynski, and I represent Minnesota Public Television, or Friends of Minnesota Public Television. This has been a great process. It's been very transparent. In fact, public television and public education radio stations are AMPRs and NPR. We've been following this process basically for a lot of years. We're pretty used to having audited statements, providing that to the agency, and going through this entire process. And so we were very comfortable with it. We looked at the grants agreements. It actually simplified our lives a little bit. But all the information we've been providing this since this function was transferred to the Department of Administration in 1975 from the State Arts Board, the Public Broadcasting was once part of that group. So it was transferred in 1975. And I know the person who wrote the executive order. In fact, he's your witness before you right now, Madam Chair. So
you were commissioner.
We actually did all of this stuff in those days, required this function. So we're pleased. That part works. Let me clarify with just one thing. Under Chapter 129, public television receives matching grants. In other words, we don't get money until we match, until we raise it locally. The statute lays out a formula on how we get grants, and we're amending part of that section here. So there really is no oversight. It's a matter of you raise the money, you apply then to the state of Minnesota for this grant. There was no specificity how it's to be used or anything else. When it comes to the equipment grants, or this legislature has given us $14 million in digital grants, we've always laid out how, well, we've gotten equipment grants and digital grants, conversion grants, we've always laid out exactly how we're going to spend the money, what was bought with it. We submit resolutions to the agency, then we provide audited statements next year. Here's how we spent the money, and here's how we plan on spending the money going forward next year under this grant. And that's what they're asking for now. So the transparency is there. Audited statements are required. We're very comfortable with all this.
Mr. Tilley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Barry Tilley. I represent the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations, AMPRs. And you probably saw some of our members that were here yesterday for public, it was a lot to other people for Public Radio Day on the Hill. I want to start out by saying we are very pleased to be part of the grant process and department administration. Personally, I want to represent a group that's getting grants legally and sending them legally, and I am very pleased that the department administration is in charge of that grant making and making sure those grants are administered fairly and accurately. I also wanted to point out that in the bill before you, the Section 5 of the Residential Housing raised a question about, that was not a part of the recommendations of the Department of Administration or the Department of Management and Budget, but that's something that public broadcasters sought for just a little clarification. This provision came into being when Representative Phil Kreinke chaired the State Government Finance Division, where our grants were go through in those days, and he raised the issue that what if one of these public radio stations or public TV stations was sold? He wanted to make sure the money came back to the state. We all agree with that. But when you look at the exact word of the law, our equipment grants and our other grants often buy stuff that wears out.
Yeah.
And if, you know, we dispose of them, sometimes we trade them in for new equipment. sometimes we'll sell them to another public radio station, and it makes it very unworkable. If we're buying a transmitter or a tower, that makes sense. They last for 20 or 30 years. But a laptop computer, a CD player, a turntable, and believe it or not, my station still plays vinyl, they wear out, and we have to dispose of those. And under the technicalities of the law, you have to keep track of where all that goes. In case the station's ever sold, we have to pay the state back, which we have no problem with because nobody ever intends to sell the station, but the record keeping gets burdensome. That's why we, the public broadcasters, thought the 5-year limit on that.
Thank
Any
you.
Other questions? I'd be more than happy to.
Thank you, Mr. Hilly. Ms. Hilden.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Nancy Hilden. I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Public Radio this morning simply to just say ditto to what you've already heard, and we do appreciate the willingness of the Department of Admin to sit down with us and just work on both the details of this draft language and also the grant documents themselves. So we're very pleased with that.
Thank you. Representative Stolberg.
Well, Madam Chair, I think testimony has been given and time's up, so let's look forward to any other additional testimony.
Madam Chair, I wanted to add one more thing.
Mr. Kelly.
Historically, because our grants are administered by the Department of Administration, if there are allotments, cutbacks, budget reductions, that department is sometimes penalized percentage-wise because our grants have been administered by the department. Often, and most times, our grants are already distributed to our entities, and the department administration then has to take our proportional share out of the rest of their budget, which is not fair. I'm glad they're not taking them out of our budget, but...
Mr. Tilley, I think you better go to Representative Kahn's committee and make that notification.
I just wanted to bring that up.
We appreciate the generosity of the Department of Administration, but there's nothing we can do about it in this committee. So you go to Representative Kahn and get on her agenda. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Representative Stolberg. I'll be back in touch with you because this is going to move along with us. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move the minutes of the 14th meeting from Monday, March 9, as submitted.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is, the minutes are adopted as printed. And then, members, our next meeting is Monday, and we have similar presentations by the public and various people that want to give us input on outdoor heritage and arts access, arts education, and Minnesota's history and culture, and anyone else that thinks that they have a vision and expectation of how that money can be used that fits our goals and priorities.
And Madam Chair, I wonder, do we have to bring dinner and breakfast?
Well, I think perhaps that's true, but I expect that we will start the agenda at 4:30 and we will continue until the last person has testified. On Monday night, that happened at 10:15. And I appreciate all those that were able to stay through because you were wonderful and we learned so much.
We'd like to correct that though because we think it was
10:30.
It was 10:30. No, it was 10:15, but even then there were people that were willing to stand around and chit chat right here in this room until after 10:20. I know that for a fact. This meeting is adjourned.